Our sponsor for this week's podcast is Retrofret Vintage Guitars in Brooklyn, New York. As loyal Fretboard Journal readers may remember, we featured these guys way back in Fretboard Journal number 18, and for very good reason. Retrofret currently has over 300 vintage acoustic and electric instruments for sale. They have a world-class inventory of guitars, basses, banjos, and mandolins and amps for you to try out in their casual and inviting showroom. And if you live in New York City or travel there and have not been to Retrofret yet, you need to get yourself over there. It is quite an experience and quite a journey. Some of their current pieces include a 58 Strat, a rare F10 mandolin, and even Dave Dudley's personal 1952 Gibson J200. Founded by luthier Steve Urich, for over 35 years, Retrofret has also been known for top-notch repairs and historically accurate restorations. So go check out their inventory at retrofret.com and be sure to follow their Instagram account for the latest. I can guarantee you, you will learn about some instruments that you have never seen before, as well as some cool old favorites. And please tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you if you reach out to them. Welcome to a very gloomy Seattle and the Fretboard Journal's 141st podcast. I hope you are doing great. Today is another fun episode. I'm talking to Ethan Gruska, formerly of the Bell Brigade and now the creator behind a brilliant solo album called Slow Motionary. We did a video with Ethan some 5 years ago, I think, here at the Fretboard Journal, and I wasn't really aware which direction he was going in over the last 5 years. I didn't know he was working on a solo project. I have to say, I was blown away when I got to hear this record. If you are into Elliott Smith or Nick Drake or Randy Newman or any of the classic singer-songwriter albums from the 60s and 70s, which I happen to be way into, you need to check this project out. Our friend Blake Mills is on it too, if you need that extra incentive. It's on Spotify, it's on iTunes, it's on Amazon, all the usual channels. I don't often recommend music on this podcast, as you know, but I have to say I really like this record, so I hope you will enjoy hearing the story behind it and enjoy checking it out. We also did a video with Ethan that is on Fretboard Journal right now with the single from the album, so you can check that out as well. If you have not joined the Fretboard Journal magazine yet, what are you waiting for? You can subscribe today at fretboardjournal.com. One-year subscriptions are just $40 and get you 4 issues delivered straight to your door in our protective cardboard mailer. As an added bonus, you can use the coupon code PODCAST and you'll save a few extra bucks. So I hope you guys will join us. I know we have listeners to this show from around the world, and we would love to send you the Fretboard Journal magazine, which is what this podcast is really all about. As you hopefully know, we have a ton of content as well on fretboardjournal.com that you will never find anywhere else. Today, we just posted an interview with Matt from Mule Resophonic Guitars. I hope you enjoy that. We also have new videos with Grant Gordy, Noam Pikilny, the Punch Brothers, Lincoln Barr, and TK Smith. And next week, I can let you guys know, we're going to release another one of our solo Bill Frisell videos. I think you'll like this one. I know these days no one browses websites anymore. You just get your feed from Facebook or Instagram or Twitter and land on an article that way. But if you go to our homepage, fretboardjournal.com, and poke around, I think you will find some cool stuff that you didn't know we had been working on. All right, we're going to get to our interview with Ethan Gruska. I hope you like it. We have more podcasts coming, one every Thursday. We've got the Foo Fighters' Chris Shiflett coming up, along with plenty of other surprises. So if you haven't subscribed to the Fretboard Journal podcast via iTunes, please do so you get all the episodes, and please don't forget to leave us a review on there because it helps us out with our search ranking. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Ethan.
Yo, what's up, dude?
How are you?
Good.
Thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Oh my God, it's such an honor.
So when we last saw you, you were in the Bell Brigade.
Yes, like five years ago, I think.
It was 5 years ago.
Yep.
So where does the Bell Brigade stand right now before we get to the fun stuff?
The Bell Brigade stands right now where it always, it forever will be, which is that me and Barbara are brother and sister. So we are constantly going to be around each other, being creative with each other. And, you know, our lives are going to be the same in that regard. We're taking like an indefinite hiatus from doing the band professionally and like being the sort of all eggs in one basket thing.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the reason why I think both of us just wanted to diversify. It's just not happening right now, but I have a feeling that somewhere down the line we'll make another record or do something.
Got it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this new record, because it It blew me away when I first heard it.
Thank you.
Still does.
Cool.
It's got a definite, like, what, late 60s, early 70s singer-songwriter cool. California vibe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I can't help but that's the stuff that I like. Yeah. So if that comes through, then that would make sense. I'll take that.
Yeah. So where were you? Did this start percolating a while ago? Did you know it was going to become an album? Did you know this was the direction you were headed in?
Not really. You know, when we decided to sort of stop doing Bell Brigade stuff, I was just left in sort of a limbo area, wondering what I would do, thinking that maybe I would be writing for other people, which I have started doing, just figuring out an alternate route to do music, maybe not being the guy, you know. But I was writing these songs from the record, and they were just obviously not going to be for anybody else because they were too, like, quiet and weird and personal, really.
Yeah.
And so I kind of was thinking, after three or four of them were written, maybe I'll make some sort of project, even if it's just to give to my musician friends to either remind them or show them that I am actually a piano player.
Yeah.
You know, the record is really a piano record, yeah, with some guitar songs put in there, but I don't consider myself a guitarist. I understand the piano, whereas the guitar is a series of happy accidents for me, which is kind of why I love it. But so I went and took like four or five songs to my friend Tony Berg,
yeah,
and played them for him just for advice, not to do anything, just to sort of, he's just great at giving advice.
Yeah.
He's a mentor to like all of Los Angeles.
Blake Mills mentions him a lot.
Yeah, but yeah. Blake has a very close relationship with Tony, and I kind of went to Tony. I've known Tony for a while. He's a family friend too, but I went to him knowing his relationship with Blake and how important that was. And Blake is like my favorite artist. So I kind of was like, you know, I would like to see what somebody like that has to say about these songs. And I played three or four of them, and they're really short, the ones that I played him. And they're the shortest songs on the record, which was kind of the idea to write a bunch of songs under 2 minutes that sort of had enough complexity to sound finished being short. Anyway, I played them for Tony, and Tony basically was like, what are you doing next month?
Uh-huh.
And I'll make this with you, and we'll worry about everything later. And that's what we did. And he told me to go write a few more. So I went and wrote some more songs, and then we peppered in these guitar songs that a lot of them were like old starts for Bell Brigade songs.
Okay.
And, you know, the guitar songs really were what made us realize that it's like going to be a solo record instead of like just this little piano project.
Yeah.
And then just kind of kept going from there, and now I'm pursuing it again and being the guy like I thought I wouldn't be.
So, were those sessions just you with piano at Tony's place?
Yeah, so okay. Those sessions, a lot of the record was done live in the way that I'm singing and playing at the same time. You know, there's definitely a little bit of studio magic with piecing together some performances,
yeah,
but everything is like, you know, it's a very arrhythmic record. There's not a lot of rhythm. It's very free in that way, and so, you know, playing and singing it live was the only way to get my sort of weird ebb and flow.
Yeah.
And yeah, the first couple weeks we made the record in about a month over the course of like 5 months because of everybody's schedule.
Sure.
And you know, the first 2 weeks were just tracking,
yeah,
just basically me and Tony and my friend Joseph Lorge, who engineered the record with Tony. And then a few other musicians came in the last week, and then we just sort of like finished it off. One of those musicians being Blake,
yeah,
which was, if you want to hear real guitar playing on my record, you can listen to the second track where Blake, Maestro Mills, is playing. Yeah.
So do you have to mimic that on the road now by yourself?
No way. I would never dare. Yeah. I'm already like trying to mimic him enough. Like,
okay.
Like, but no, there's no mimicking that guy.
Yeah.
He's his own beast.
So you spent months working on this record that you didn't even think was going
to
be a record.
Yeah. Like when I talked to Tony originally, I was sort of like, I mean, this is going to sound like pretentious and silly and immature, but I was kind of like, I really want to make this like an artistic statement more than like a commercial thing. And he was like, well, don't release it. And I was like, I thought about that for a while, just being like, yeah, maybe this is really just for me to feel like I can do something different than what I've been doing, and maybe to show other musicians, because I also wanted to be doing more sessions, like as a keyboard player. Okay. And it originally it was more of like a maybe going to be like a futuristic business card.
Yep.
And it's slowly becoming just, you know, I mean, it is that, but it's, I'm trying to do a little bit more with it and see if I can, you know, make this a real part of my career. But, you know, I'm doing other stuff as well. That's kind of like making sure I don't fall into the same trap that I did a few years ago, which was only doing one thing, which is something that I don't think I can do again. It's just too crazy.
So when did the record label come into the play?
The record label came in after it was done. Wow. So me and Tony played it for Bob Cleaner Mountain when we were finishing it up, and Bob basically did the same thing that Tony did. He was just like, yep, I'll do it. I'll do it now, and we'll figure it out later. And I was like, what? So that was really cool. And so we had it mixed, and then we showed it to a couple places, and my friend Lenny Warrenker, who I had worked with Bell Brigade, heard it and was really into it. And I never thought that I would be back at Warner Brothers, but because we left, and I figured they're never going to have me back. And
you thought they were pissed?
Well, I didn't know if they were pissed. I just thought that, like, it's one of those things, you know, like you leave, and then it's you're dead to me, even if it's amicable. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't dead to him, which is awesome. And he showed it to Robin Hurley and Seymour Stein, and they showed an interest that just made me feel like, just grateful that anybody had interest, and especially people who were going to help me like do what I'm doing now, which is go on a tour and make like license a really cool photograph for the cover. And so the label thing was an afterthought to the project, but now that I have one, you know, I'm thinking more and more about how to continue this road,
the solo career,
I guess.
Is it weird? I mean, the album feels to me like it's pretty personal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is it weird that some of these songs are actually seeing the light of day?
Yeah, totally. I was talking to somebody about it. Yeah, I mean, it's weird to like be writing songs about your life and like maybe like the struggles in your life, mm-hmm. and then having other people like read into them. But you know, the saving grace is that usually when I write a song, it's not just about one person. Yeah. So if I'm talking either trash or like fears or whatever about somebody in my life, like I don't really have to worry about them being like, yo, like you shouldn't be discussing our secrets in public, because, you know, when I start a song, maybe one person is in mind, but you know, it often, those feelings within a relationship often permeate to others, and then those other peripheral people start sort of mm-hmm. entering into the song, and then hopefully by the time the song is done, it's less of a personal thing and more of a universal thing. But no, I mean, this record is very much like those 2 years of my life.
Yeah, crazy.
And my childhood a little bit, just sort of like having the classic, like the older you get, the more like the early memories sort of like take on weight that they didn't even have then. Yeah. You know?
So what, describe your childhood. There's obviously a musical family.
Yeah. So I mean, my childhood is, I mean, I hope my record doesn't come across like I'm complaining about my childhood. Yeah. I had a great childhood and I have a great family. But like I said, there are things that the way that you come up, like you don't realize you're coming up that way because you're just in the middle of it. But it's that 20/20 hindsight where the things that I go through now emotionally, like, you know, you can sort of go back and piece together, not why, but like how. And that just felt, I hadn't really touched on that before, because it was all of my writing until that point was like centered in the current thought, and this is a little bit retrospective for me. I also think that, you know, I'm getting married in July.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And you know, starting another chapter of your life always sort of like makes you look back at the other chapters.
Of course. Yeah.
And I think that that had something to do with it too. So, yeah, I mean, I probably shouldn't talk too much about like my all the personal details because they're basically already in this. The songs are like kind of like, you know, it's not hard to read through the lines or between the lines. So, and again, I shouldn't disclose everybody's personal information and social security number.
That's all right. There is something to be said for cleaning up your mess before you start a new chapter and kind of processing.
Yeah, no, that's actually a really good way of putting it. I don't know if my mess will ever be clean because I'm always going to be able to shoot a hole through something. But but no, I think the further I get away from this record, I realize what you just said. It's just sort of like kind of starting the next phase.
Totally. So piano was your first instrument?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first songs I wrote on piano.
Classically trained? Or
I wouldn't say classically trained, but like I definitely... Like, I was self-taught as a teenager, and then when I went to a school called Cal Arts for a year in L.A., and I studied composition for a year and took some piano lessons with this wonderful woman. And so I had a couple lessons, but I'm more self-taught than I am trained. But I'm slowly trying to learn more and retrain myself, you know, in that way, because I think that it'll just advance me. But it's hard.
Do all the songs start out on piano at this point when you're songwriting?
Lately, yeah. I feel like I should. I actually have been having an itch like to write more on guitar because I've sort of like deserted it for the last year.
Yeah.
And you know, it's that thing. Like I wrote almost all the Bell Brigade songs on guitar because I didn't know what I was doing. And like I mean they're very simple, but like it felt revelatory, even the simplest thing, because I was like, whoa,
chord progression.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Chord progression on an instrument that I don't understand, and it just the accidents like tumbled upon themselves into a song.
Got it.
And then when I wrote these songs on the piano, it was coming back to an instrument that I did understand, but it felt like that same thing, like making mistakes that we're like, whoa, that's cool. Maybe that's the beginning of a song. And so now the guitar, it's just a constant like back and forth of like trying to play the instrument that I don't remember how to play. And it's conducive to writing for me in that sort of process.
You'll perfect both and have to take up the saxophone or something.
Well, yeah, definitely not going to perfect both, but but I have been thinking to myself, I should find an instrument that I completely don't understand and try to play it, so that, because I think songs come out of it. That was my problem as a kid trying to like take lessons, is that I would be learning something and then I would make a mistake or freeze on one bar and then start writing my own song around what was happening in that one bar. And that still happens to me. Like I'll be trying to read through a Chopin thing and I'm like, oh my god, this bar is crazy, and then it starts a song. So my attention span is crap and getting worse because of my damn phone.
We're all in that boat.
Yeah.
What you had a Yamaha guitar?
Yeah, here. So yeah. I think it's an FG-110.
Okay.
I got it at True Tone in LA, and I love it. I mean, that's like kind of my main writing guitar because it's sort of like pedestrian sounding and like dead and not regal, and it just like, if I have a really pretty sparkly guitar, I have a tendency to like the song will end up being like too pretty or cute, and this sort of like helps me be a little bit more like down to earth. I don't know. And I also love it because I think that it's the Elliott Smith guitar. I think his might be another body type, but I know he played those 70s Yamahas, and he's one of my favorite guitarists and songwriters.
Your single has a definite Elliott Smith
vibe
to it.
Somebody was like, you can't put that out. This is shameless. And it is, in a way. I mean, like, it's very, very inspired by him, but whatever, because I'm really inspired by him. I mean, he truly is, and maybe my favorite songwriter. I mean, he's the guy that made me want to be a musician, his records.
Yeah. You see yourself heading in a poppier direction like he did towards the end?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the thing is that I think I started pretty poppy.
Yeah, you did.
And and so I'm sort of like trying to rebel against that and like get a little more obtuse. But, you know, like I said, I'm writing for other people, and like that sort of helps me get that poppy energy out to like sort of not worry about if it's like cool enough or like left of center enough, and just sort of like I like hooks and whatever. I'll check out the radio every once in a while. It's just research and development, but also it's kind of fun and I like it.
Yeah. So what does that look like when you're writing for other people? Are you like thinking about the person before you write the song, or are you like, hey, I'm gonna write a pop hit right now?
Well, it depends. Like, it depends on like what the the project is, like the assignment really. But like a good, like sometimes I am thinking like, oh man, like it'd be cool to like write a pop hit. I haven't done that, but and so I'll try to do that without anybody in mind and just go for like the catchiness.
Yeah.
But you know, Blake was producing John Legend and I wrote a song on that record, and I remember that day Blake was like, would you want to try writing something? I was like, dude, yes, please. And I sort of like tried to pawn off like five or six songs that I had previously written and sort of finished, being like, would this work? And thinking, you know, the poppier side.
Yeah.
And Blake was like, no. And I sort of left that meeting feeling like, oh man, I blew my chance. And then that night I wrote a song that felt like more me and what would maybe be the more accessible thing that could have gone on this record, and that ended up being the start of the song that made it to his record, which is a song about his daughter that we all three ended up working on.
What was that like?
That was super cool. I mean, that it's pretty fresh. Like, that record came out a couple months ago, but for me, you know, it's a really big deal because he's such like a famous artist that it's a nice thing to be able to. It was a really good experience for me, and I'm really happy because they used a song that I was a part of that I think is cool and not empty. Like, it has a lot of changes that I'm proud of and lyrics that I think came out good. And so and like I said, Blake can do no wrong for me, and
he did a great album with
that. And I just, anything that he's involved in, like if he hollers, I'm there instantly.
So you delivered a song that you wrote, like part of a song that you wrote in one night.
Yeah, and then Blake sort of like put his paws on it, and so did John.
Did they write lyrics to it, or?
It was sort of a lot of like, it ended up being very collaborative. Like the start happened, and then we all had this dialogue about like how to finish it off, and it just kind of came together like how most collaborative songs do, where somebody's got to start and then you just sort of like put the Legos together, you know.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Any other songs you've written of note that I should know
about? I don't know. Well, yeah, I've written a song for a band called Joseph.
Okay.
They're great, three sisters, and there's a couple more coming soon.
All right.
It's one of those things, like, I don't believe it till I see it. And, but hopefully, more will be appearing in the coming months.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're touring for this record right now.
Yeah.
And that's what, another week or two?
It's another week and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been about 3 weeks almost.
Yeah.
And then another week and a half. And, it's been great. It's opening for a Danish artist named Aunice Obel.
Okay.
She's really cool, and her music is immersive and beautiful. So is the show, and her audiences are really cool. They are not chatty and like drunk, you know, and that's kind of rare. So for my music, which is, like I said, arrhythmic and quiet and personal, like, it's a blessing for me to not have to be like trying to yell over drunk dudes.
Yeah.
So that's been great.
Yeah. We just shot some videos with you, and I'm assuming some of your guitar technique must come from the piano playing, because there's a little more middle finger on the right?
Yeah, I don't know. It might be. I think you know, when I'm playing guitar, like if I'm thinking theoretically in any way, which is minimal, but if I am, like I'm in my mind picturing the piano and then coming back and then like figuring out what that means on guitar. So it's like I'm always like one step away, you know what I mean? I'm twice removed while I'm playing. So, but yeah, I think like inner movements like are, you know, they make much more sense to me on piano because they're just like right in front of you and linear.
Yeah.
And so I guess I like that feeling and that those harmonic movements. And so on guitar, I'm trying more and more to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And sort of crawl around.
No pick.
No pick.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like picks. And I picks are cool. And but yeah, I have this like thing, it's just the most comfortable way of playing. I also have the best time with my fingers.
Yeah.
With a pick, my wrist is not as like controlled as like my fingers. I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but I used to do card tricks when I was a kid.
Really?
And it sort of like helps like finger dexterity for me, and like, you know, it just feels more comfortable and in control to play with my fingers.
You still do the card tricks?
Yeah, actually. I got not really sick. I had like a really, really bad cold like 2 years ago.
Okay.
And I just like couldn't get up and do anything. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go back and learn a couple of the card tricks that I used to know. And I got really into it. I was bugging everybody that I knew, like showing them card tricks and card tricks and card tricks. And finally, I had to calm down. I'm not into it really anymore. But I do love it. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. It's sort of musical, like, when do you reveal something? When do you like misdirect? Like, and the people that invent card tricks are pretty brilliant. Like, that you have this idea and then you have to like reverse engineer with like this super limited medium. So I think it's pretty
badass.
Do you
have like tips for anyone who wants to learn card tricks?
Anyone who wants to learn card tricks. Yeah, like, I mean, it's super easy. Now you can just go on YouTube now and learn tricks. But I think the tip would be there's like three or four maneuvers that if you learn, like, you can do hundreds of tricks. They sort of are the basis of, like, similar to guitar. You learn a couple chords and you can write a lot of songs.
All right.
But then, of course, if you want to move on, there are deeper moves that I definitely can't do.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Like guitar.
Thanks for being on the podcast, Ethan.
Totally, man.
This was fun.
Thank you so much for having me.